Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings. I am Brian Nemhauser. You can find me, all the stuff that we do at Hawk Blogger on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Apple Podcast, Spotify, all those places. And it's a Blue Friday before one of the biggest games in franchise history for the Seahawks as they battle the 49ers for the number one seed in the NFC. And if it's a Friday, it means we've got a good pal, Mike Sando from The Athletic, on how are you doing on this 2026 new year?
Great, Brian. Thanks for having me on. And I'm so looking forward to the games this weekend, the Seattle game in its own slot there, you know, Saturday night. That's just going to be a fun one. I think Hawk fans are a little bit nervous around here, you know.
Yeah, 49ers
had a little mojo going in their game, you know, and yeah, look, they're playing the Bears. There's no defense played in that game, but still, you see them having fun and it feels like they're hitting stride and they're playing with house money, man. Anything they've done, we're talking Mike Kyle Shanahan, coach of the year. If they lose this game, who cares? I mean, they're already a success story, right? And it feels like for the Seahawks, look, they're in the playoffs either way, but if you got the number one seed right there and you can't beat the 49ers, you get swept by the 49ers. Like, hey, aren't Seahawks fans here? Like, we got Mike McDonald and it's a new game in this division. And it still could be if they lose this game, but it's not so emphatic if they lose this game. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, that's one of the things I think folks like you and I love about covering sports is the endless potential multiverse of narratives that can come out of it, from the individual player to the coaches, to the cities, to the franchises.
Yes.
And, you know, there's going to be bards out there spinning their tails one way or another. And we don't get to know what those stories really are going to be until the game gets played.
You've been stirring it up before the game with your own pregame narratives on these 49er fans. I've noticed that, you know, you do a great job of blending the analysis with being a fan, but it's leaning a little fan heavy here late in the week. What's your feel? Are you having fun?
I actually am glad you brought that up. So folks that don't know, like, Mike is somebody who not only I consider a friend, but has been like a mentor a bit during this process. And I've always looked to him for kind of the standard on how, you know, how to cover things and how to handle things.
Yeah.
And Mike is all class. And there's I don't know, maybe it was last year. I think I was getting into it with somebody and he's kind of like, maybe you want to ease off of that. Maybe you want to like rise above that a little bit and not get into the mud and wrestle. And it was good advice. You remember that conversation?
I do now. I forgot about it then, you know, but I've watched you kind of, you know, become a journalist, and yet you're a Seahawk fan. That's part of it. You're not fooling anybody. You know, you're not trying to. Nope. So there's a line there that makes it is different. But like for me, you know, there was always that extra factor of like, I literally was not a fan of the Seahawks. I had season tickets to the Raiders know, years ago. But that all left me when I started covering. Like, I had a different experience to where I went from being as big of a fan as you could ever be to really losing that, because I got so into the career and covering it that literally, yes, I'm still partial to the teams I grew up rooting for or whatever, but I don't have any affinity for the Raiders right now at all. And people 30 years ago wouldn't say that's impossible, because I was at the first game when they moved back to Oakland. They played the Chargers. Yeah. I would fly down to the games. I've walked from the airport to the stadium like an idiot. You know, I mean, I've done whatever level of fandom I've done. And then it went away and that's a different experience. You're still doing that and balancing it. So you're different.
I think you gotta lean into
who you are. You know, you gotta lean into what you do and who you are, but to be good at that, to be as credible as you can be as an analyst, there's probably a line where you don't want to be as a fan.
Yes.
And I don't think you blurred that. I don't think you have, but for people that don't know you or don't know what you do, is your credibility as an analyst helped or hurt by wearing a Seahawk hat, right? Yeah. It's probably not helped, even though your analysis might be better than somebody.
Yes.
You're right. We can see that
100%.
Your analysis doesn't affect it.
So, I know this. I mean, Robert Mays, who's a friend of the show, is, you know, continues to acknowledge that he's a Bears fan. He wears Bears hats on the Athletic football show. I know that he's been counseled to not do that, and to not, you know, demonstrate any preference towards any fan base or any team. And look, this is probably not what I want to hear, but I'm enjoying the conversation, so we're going to keep going. I hear it a lot that, you know, being a fan is some sort of pejorative term. And personally, like, I very much respect reporters who do like classic journalism and get to the point you're at where there's like no bias involved. I think there's 100% need for that and value in that.
Yeah.
I also think, and I would say I know, that it invites a different kind of analysis and a different depth of analysis. And the best, like you, will still do interesting, ask interesting questions, do interesting stories, dive for interesting data. But a lot of folks, it leads to very like superficial, seen it a
million. Detached. They're detached.
Yes, exactly. And so having that connection to the emotion, to me, that's part of what gets me to do the analysis. So to give, for people who don't know what we're talking about, David Lombardi, who covers the 49ers, who in my mind very clearly is a fan, but does not acknowledge being a fan, and has a very, very slanted perspective that comes out in his stuff. You know, he was bragging about his views on YouTube. And I, after I saw Grant Cohen giving him some hassle, I decided to join in. And David didn't like it that much. And so we kind of went back and forth. And I'll say this, you know, to me, like, anyone that takes themselves seriously in this, like, shame on you. Like, we're not interesting. Like, the guys that are doing unbelievable things on the football field, they're interesting. We just talk about them. And so I sent to David this just before the show. Nobody cares about us. It's silly to have an ego about what we do. But how about this? Since we're both clearly fans of our respective teams, if the 49ers win, I will donate $1,000 to a food bank down in the Bay Area. If the Seahawks win, you do the same. So the challenge is out there, Mr. Lombardi. Let's acknowledge that we're fans, and let's do some good in the world.
What are you doing, disturbing this? For people who don't know, the Grant Cohn versus David Lombardi thing is hilarious to me. Now, I'm sure it's super annoying to David, who I've worked with. I mean, David's a friend of mine, but I actually have, you know, on Twitter, you can have different lists. And I have like one Twitter list that's just like the main news transactional reporters, right? Just if I need to see, are they reporting this, I can go and it'll be Schefter and Diana Rossini and Rappaport and Pellicero. That's it, right? And then I have another one. I used to have one like all the NFC West when I was doing it. I have one that's just Cohn and Lombardi because I want to see sometimes. And for those who don't know, Grant's dad, Lowell, you know, was a columnist at the Center of the Press Democrat. And I knew him, you know, when I was covered. And then Grant was his kid, you know, and has come up in a totally different way. I mean, the mediums available to do this stuff, the non-traditional ways you can get in are kind of endless. I was just listening to Cam Newton talk about that on Norv Turner's podcast, you know, and it was very interesting about how the mediums change, but you've got to come up with something that's interesting, right? So so Grant Cohn is kind of, he's kind of been this outsider guy who's chirping at everything, but now he's also inside, like he's credentialed. So it's very unusual to have two people that are credentialed publicly spatting, right? Like it'd be like, you know, me and back in the day, me and Art Thiel or something probably would not be. Now, maybe we would, maybe people would be if social media was around then, because there was every bit of the personalities. There's been fist fights in press boxes and a lot of stuff, but usually it hasn't made it into the public. And so Grant Cohn just peppers David Lombardi all the time on Twitter. And he's got a big enough following himself now that like it's hard to ignore. But David never replies. I don't think he ever replies to him, does he? I think he doesn't acknowledge that he exists, which is its own thing. That's like interesting to me. Like, like, how would I handle that if someone was just coming at me? I would totally be replying.
Yes.
You know, well, I think I would have a little bit of fun with it.
I find it endlessly amusing. And just generally, people that take themselves too seriously are folks that are going to be, yeah, like they're going to be in my crosshairs a little bit. Like anybody on this planet, honestly, should not take themselves too seriously. I got to ask you, man, you talked about fist fights in press box. Can you give us one of those stories?
Oh, let me think about it. That's a good one.
You don't have to spill any things that you're not allowed to.
If I knew I was going to talk about this, I could probably come up with a couple. Like, who would have gone at it? My gosh.
It's okay if it's not right.
I can't think of one, but maybe like for next week, you know. I know that there's been.
I promise you, it won't be me. It won't be me.
No, I know that there's been. That stuff happens. I mean, you know, there's going to be. You know, one of the settings where that type of thing can happen is the some of the more stressful interactions would be at those big. Everyone crowds around a locker, or everyone crowds around an individual at a high leverage moment, and so there becomes a positioning, especially by camera crews. And so you get some guys that are got sharp elbows, but those guys have to get the shot or they're going to be, you know, there's pressure on those guys. So yeah, they got to get they have to get the prime spot. But then they're not out there every day. They're not like part of the group as much always. And then you got me or Dave Bowling or some of these other guys, and we're intense too, you know, in that moment. And you'll get guys actually physically positioning. It's like you're under the basket. So that can do that. I've seen that escalate into, you know, close to going. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. There's a whole little like underworld of media life that I've gotten a little bit of a peek into. It's really interesting. It's like walking through the stadiums after games, the underbelly of the stadium and like all the splendor of these football stadiums. Then you see behind the scenes and how just like, you know, backstage it looks.
One of the dynamics is in the press box of people talking and saying things. And so you in a press box, you're going to have the PR staffs from both teams. You're going to have the reporters from both teams. And sometimes you're going to have a row with like the Packers front office. You know, I remember sitting there in the Seahawks press box. There's Ted Thompson, you know, the GM and three of his underlings. They're all right there. And they're super emotionally invested, but you're not supposed to cheer in the press box. And so those guys are sitting there. And then some reporters like up in the front row, like giving his own commentary. That's annoying to me. That's like disrespectful to me, but they're like, Oh, this guy sucks. You know? And the GM of the team is right there. Like,
I've witnessed exactly what you're talking about regularly.
Time when the 49ers Seahawks were playing in San Francisco, this happened, the coaches of the 49ers just lost the game. And so they poured out of their coach's booth and they're pissed. You know, they won. I think the 49ers might have won.
They won.
Yeah. And Greg Roman was the OC and he yelled, I forget what he yelled, but he yelled in the press box, like, you know, F and take that, you know, so it was kind of cool, but it showed there's a lot of emotions up there and the media are supposed to be the least emotional of any of them. So why should the media should not be a part of that to me?
No, they should not be. I get that. And, you know, I don't know if I told you, but during the Seahawks Rams game down in LA, Marshawn Lynch was in the press box.
Seahawks Rams game?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was he sitting like where the media would sit?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, and he had to be like talking probably. Funny.
That's the thing. He and his friends got warned at least once or twice. But, man, awesome. that was really entertaining. I mean, almost
was it Dave Pearson warning him? The PR?
No, it was not. But Dave was very close by, and their relationship's pretty funny. And
Dave and Marshawn's relationship is hilarious. They were on a podcast, a Seahawk podcast, one time that was very funny.
Yes, yeah. Yes, it was great. So, with all that in mind, we've got this game and. I think there's only been a handful of these types of games in the history of the NFL, Mike. I don't have for certain an exhaustive list, but as far as a final game of the regular season, winner takes all, number one seed in the conference, I've only come up with two other times that it's happened. One was 1993 when the Giants faced the Cowboys. Both teams were 11-4. And the Cowboys won that game 16-13 in overtime. And then last year with Detroit against Minnesota in 2024, yeah. For the last week of season, and a certain Sam Darnold has familiarity with that game. And then there'll be this one. Do you have any others you're aware of that?
No, I don't, but that makes sense to me because, okay, first off, how many times has the number one seed decided in the last week? So right now you're narrowing that down. Then what are the odds that the two teams in the conference would happen to be scheduled that week? That's the super rare thing, because a lot of times they pack these division games at, you know, towards the end of the season, maybe to win a division or something like that. But the odds of two teams in one, how about the odds of two teams in one division? That's what we're talking about. Every one of these you mentioned is two teams in the same division.
It's true.
For the top seed. True. So it's a rarity to have that. I can see that. I can't imagine there's many more of those.
What, when you look at this game as someone who is not, does not have a rooting interest, what do you see? Like, what catches your attention?
Yeah, I think we're all, you know, for me, I'm very interested in kind of what happened around week 11, 12, when teams started playing Seattle's offense a little differently. And if you watch, as mentioned, we were talking about Grant Cohn, but Grant Cohn asked Robert Saleh, the D coordinator, a couple of good questions this week about how much do you blitz? How much do you travel your corner with different guys? And really, Saleh's replies were all coming from the orientation of, we don't want to allow explosive plays, right? So we don't want to blitz because we'd rather just put a blanket and give up something, but not too much. And I think that's what's happened to Seattle. Remember in the first half of the year, Greg Olsen kept saying, what are these defenses doing? They're playing the run. They're falling for the bait with Seattle by playing the run on early downs, and Seattle's throwing it over their head. I don't think it's that simple. I think there's also issues of personnel with Seattle where you've had you know, some different players, you know, their tight end Arroyo has been not on the field as much. You've had Rashid Shaheed has been, you know, in and out a little bit here or there. Horton, you know, is a very nice draft pick who has some big playability that we're not even talking about anymore. He's been out. And so I think there's a combination of some personnel things that have happened to Seattle too. But I really do feel like their big play offense has been solved until further notice. And all we're seeing is their ability to survive with a great defense and make some plays and maybe pull out a game here or there. But that is not as dominant as their point total would make you think. I feel like they're in a little bit more of a tenuous situation here where we're seeing these games be close at halftime. And if you're playing Carolina, maybe you pull away. Your defense makes enough plays. But you get in the playoffs, you don't play teams in the second and third round who are going to implode on their own. You know, you're going to have to beat them. And so I think that's the thing. I could see this. You know, it was 17-13 the last time they played, I believe. They played the 49ers. Even if the Seahawks win, is it going to feel like, I still don't know about the offense? Where are you at on that? Because that's the thing they haven't counterpunched to. They got counterpunched on, and they're not countering that.
Well, there's actually some interesting evidence along those lines that tells a little bit of a different story. And what I'm referring to there is, if you look at the explosive play rate for the Seahawks offense, it absolutely went from historic, especially the passing game in particular. It was up over 21% explosive pass rate for the first 8 games of the season. It dipped to like under 10% against the Rams, against the Vikings. I mean, it was pedestrian, right? And we all felt that. You're watching the games, you could just see that they were kind of toothless. But over the last 4 games, that explosive passing rate's actually recovered to about 15-16%. It's not 21, but it's better. And the explosive rush rate has almost doubled along that time. So this is not to say that the Seahawks offense is now back to what it was or is a juggernaut hitting on all cylinders. But there's this kind of quiet progress being made that I think is also a metamorphosis into a offense that maybe is a little bit better equipped to play playoff football.
I'm going to give you some interesting numbers. So about the explosive rate. So if we go week 1 through 10, okay, the Seahawks saw more cover one defense, okay? And by my count, they had a 50% explosive rate against cover one. They had 16 explosives on 32 plays. Okay.
Wow.
Since then, they have one explosive in 17 plays. So what's happened is people aren't playing that anymore. You know, if you go from 16 of 32 explosive to one of 17, there's two things that change there, right? They're not playing as much.
And you're the denominator.
You're not getting as much. They're not playing that against you. And when they are, instead of 50% explosive, you're 5% explosive or whatever one of 17 is. So I will look at the last four games to see, you know, to see if that's really changed. In fact, I'm going to do it right now. I'm looking at it right now. So last four games.
Well, it can't have changed that much if it's one for 17.
Well, it's one of eight. The last four games they've faced eight plays of cover one when they're passing. They got one explosive.
Yeah.
And so kind of what's happened is they've gone from seeing more cover one and being super explosive against it to seeing it less and not being explosive at all. And then their explosiveness against cover two has always been kind of low, which is normal. You know, you're not going to do as much against that. And then, you know, some of the other coverage, I think, has just been okay. So it's something to look at, something that I'm going to be looking at coming out of this game. And I would imagine, I haven't looked at the 49ers breakdowns, but I bet you they're not playing a lot of cover one anyway, right?
They're a cover three team, which often converts to cover one, depending on what they like to do. But they're going to be, I mean, it's Pete Carroll, you know, Robert Saleh still is of that lineage of that ilk. And so, yeah, very much predominantly cover three, which is also meant to take away the deep pass. But here's the thing, Mike, that's interesting is the Panthers were also very much a cover three defense.
Oh, yeah.
And then they played cover two.
Which you
and I know, that's a pretty big signal. Like defenses don't just like change their primary coverage of what they've been practicing and repping and playing through training camp and through all season. And then to also have some success with it, that's not a good sign. So it's not like I don't see that, but I'll be curious. I can't imagine Saleh going and playing a bunch of cover two, because that's just not what they do.
No, I totally agree. I think this is good. I think this is just, look, Seattle's explosive. You know, they're good enough in other ways that they can pull away. But what we've seen is, okay, 49ers have been a lot better on special teams, even when we take out the things they can't control. They've been better there. So that
they've
has been
better than they have been in the past. Not better,
better than they have been. I don't know if it's good as Seattle, but that has been that has been such a weakness that I think a lot of years we would come into this, or last year we'd be like, Seattle might just win this game on special teams. And they still might, but the odds of that happening are lower than they used to be.
Yes.
Then you bring the familiarity part of it, right, too, where they know Clint Kubiak better and Darnold better than anybody, because both guys were there. Now, you could say, hey, Seattle knows those guys, but Saleh wasn't there, you know.
No. When he was there. And so. I think that's absolutely right. And when I kind of look at this game, Mike, as objectively as possible, I see some things that seem very clear. The 49ers offense is probably the most confident, or confidence is the wrong word. They have been playing at the highest level of any of the units going into this game, right? I think the Seahawks defense is in that conversation, but it's also two games removed from giving up the most yards in franchise history. So like there's a little bit less there. Another thing I'd throw out, the Seahawks run game is significantly different and better than it was in week one. This is a run game that was getting stuffed 20 to 25% of the time, 0 yards or negative yards on run. They're in the like single digits a lot now, and they're one of the top 10 rushing teams in football. The 49ers defense is the worst unit of any of the units in this game.
Oh yeah.
I don't think it's close.
I agree.
And so when you look at it, special teams aside for a second, do you see that the 49ers offense has a bigger advantage over the Seahawks defense, or that the Seahawks offense has a bigger advantage over the 49ers defense?
Yep.
That I think is where it comes down to in terms of majority of how this game will play out.
I totally agree with that. And I do think that on paper, the Seahawks offense should have a good game against the 49ers defense. That's probably the bigger gap between anything. Whereas the 49er offense, Seattle defense is probably two top five units right now, you know? You would say that, but you know, you gotta like, you know, what wins in this, you know, is Seattle's offense good enough to score if it gets to be a little bit higher scoring?
You know, yeah. So you're saying more confidence. If it's a higher scoring game, it probably favors the 49ers.
Yeah. Because that would mean that the 49ers are scoring, you know, I think if the 49ers, we'll see. I think there's a reason. I think it's justifiable that Seattle fans are a little nervous.
Okay. Say more about that. Like be more.
These have always been tough games. I would love to take Arizona out of it. Look at the other games look at the other division games that Seattle's had, right?
Mm-hmm.
What were they decided by total points? 2 points
combined between the Rams two games and then
four points in the other.
Yeah.
So that's close for comfort for a team, the Seattle with the biggest point margin. You know, they win going away.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they do, when you don't win going away, it's a nervous game, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't won going away against the teams that know them the best. Now, I'm going to put Arizona in a little bit of a different category playing Jacoby Brissett and where they're at. I think the Rams and the 49ers are a little bit more heavyweights, you know?
Yeah.
Coaching and playing and everything.
I'm curious about your perspective on this specific part of this game. If the game script gets down to where it is close, like you're bringing up, on one hand, my first thought is like Brock Purdy, you know, is the advantage in that situation, right? Better quarterback, more likely to, you know, make a big play maybe. On the other hand, the Seahawks defense is also much more equipped to make the big play in that moment. And statistically, this is something no one's going to talk about going into this game. Sam Darnold's been better in game-winning situations, close and tight situations. The last two seasons, Brock Purdy's actually had one of the worst passer numbers in those situations, although he did win the first game against the Seahawks this year, right, in that kind of situation. So where do you fall if it's close and late? Who has the advantage?
I think we have seen the 49er offense be better longer than we've seen the Seahawks defense be better. Would you agree with that?
Ooh, I need you.
Over the last recent seasons.
Oh, in the last recent seasons. Sure.
I'm saying with the 49ers with Purdy and Shanahan have had a top five offense longer than the Seahawks with McDonald have had a top five defense, right?
Yes.
So I am still conditioned to feel in the back of my mind that Brock, and it even happened, I think, in the first game, that Brock Purdy can get yards on Seattle when he really needs to. I've felt that.
Mm-hmm.
You felt that?
Yeah. Yeah. He's been lights out against the Seahawks for the most part.
So I just want to see it from Seattle's standpoint. I want to see it. Go do it. I think they can do it. I think they can do it.
Does that mean, sorry to interrupt you. So does that mean that your expectation is that would be an advantage for the 49ers if it was a close and late situation? That's your
reason. It is until it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been so far. So I do think Seattle's defense is great. I love what they're doing. I think they got the right people. I think they call a great game. But, you know, it was 17-13 before, and, you know, we've just saw 38-37 or whatever. So this is a big moment to define yourself, to do it against a team that beat you last time. And I do feel like Purdy's he's hot lately. And
so tell me this, Mike.
Yeah.
What do you think has to happen for the Seahawks to win this game? Like where would be, because I think it's pretty clear you see this as advantage 49ers, and I think there's plenty of reasons to feel that way.
I would probably pick the Seahawks to win the game, though.
Really? I'm surprised to hear you say that. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the Seahawks are the better team. I do think that they're a better team just almost in all three phases. Now, offense, I feel like, is not as good right now, the last month, you know, last 2 months, last 6 weeks. But I think the Seahawks are better. But I do think that it is a big moment game on the road with a team that is a little bit dangerous, the 49ers, just a little bit house money feel to them. And it'll be great for the Seahawks if they really win it decisively, but I think it could be a really close game. And like I said, I would probably pick the Seahawks to win, but I think it's a nervous pick if you're a Seahawks fan.
100%. I mean, the way I've kind of thought about this, Mike, is there's been moment after moment in the last really couple of years where under Mike McDonald, you kind of felt this crescendo, like they were building towards something that might like kind of break them through. And then it recedes, like they don't come through. Packers last year, you know, like there's plenty of these games where it's just like kind of fell back.
Yeah.
And even the game when they broke through against the Rams, it was kind of confusing how it happened, right? You can't like, I don't think Seahawks fans came away from that like, oh, we solved all our problems, we clearly are better. It was like, it was a great game, but you don't feel super confident after that. So this is, again, the next opportunity for them to get over what has been not a super successful history in these moments. I don't think that's a Sam Darnold thing for what it's worth. I think that's a Seahawks franchise thing for the last 10 years.
Yeah. But I do think it's a new era. I do. I think that they're, you know, we've seen it. They've won on all these road games, you know, and they've this year they've won big in a lot of the games they were supposed to win big. They've found ways, been super resilient, even when they've lost, you know, they've, you know, given up the four interceptions at the Rams, and you feel like you have almost should have won the game. I mean, there's some really great signs. I think all the vital signs are good. They're great. The vital signs are great. I think they're in a really good spot. We're just talking about one game, you know. History says it's going to be close. You know, it may not be. This could be the breakout.
We will find out. Before I let you go, just to give you specific numbers, since 2023, which dates back to a really, really good season for Brock Purdy, in close and late situations defined by fourth quarter or overtime, 5 minutes or less remaining, and within 8 points. Okay. That's the close and late definition here. Brock Purdy has a passer rating of 74.5. He's thrown 2 touchdowns and 3 interceptions in those situations. Yeah. He is like 30th or 40th on this list in terms of rating. Sam Darnold, over that same period of time, 106.3 rating, 5 touchdowns, 1 pick. And he is the fourth highest rated quarterback in that situation, which is not the narrative out there, by the way.
That's a little bit surprising on Darnold that it's that efficient. Cause I say one of the things I admire about Purdy, and I really admire this about Philip Rivers when I was watching him, is when all is lost in a game, they're not afraid to throw a pick. I mean, how many times have you watched? I feel like Aaron Rodgers has like a passer rating calculator in his head and he's like, not going to do that. Would you agree?
Yes.
I feel like guys like, now I would put Darnold in this category too, though. I'm surprised. That's why I'm surprised he doesn't have a few more picks late in the game. Like I appreciate guys that aren't into that. Like they're just going to go down swinging. You got to take chances when you're behind, right?
Yeah.
I would much rather have the quarterback throw a pick on giving myself a 10% chance to make a heroic play than like I've seen Derek Carr do, throw the ball out of bounds.
Yes.
Late well, in the game.
And before I let you go, I want to pass this on from a listener. Aziz Rashid says, Brian, before Mike leaves, please give him a shout out for being all class on my flight back from New Jersey after Super Bowl 48. Talked with class and with respect.
Super Bowl 48.
Yes.
What are we on now?
Oh, you're going to ask me that, huh?
Oh, that would have been over 10 years ago, I guess. Because
I'm guessing
that's from Super Bowl 40,
that's the
right?
Seahawks Broncos Super Bowl.
Oh, okay.
In New York.
Fun.
Yes.
Well, hey, so. I'm glad that you didn't catch me. In most flights, I'm, you know, totally drunk and just causing a huge ruckus. So I'm really glad that you caught me on that one flight that I was on my best behavior.
that is your rep for round. Mike, what do you have coming up? What are you looking at for your pick six or anything else?
Yeah, well, pick six is very interesting this week because we may look ahead more at the playoff matchups and stuff. So it'll be a blend of, you know, so there's kind of a weird week with a bunch of games that don't maybe matter. I've got a couple other fun things I'm sort of working on historically. I love the history things, you know, so got a couple things that way, but not 100% sure, you know, where we'll go. I'm sure there'll be something CX 49ers, though, I can guarantee that.
It's always like the game giveth every weekend, something to talk about. And you're one of the best to follow it. So, Mike, thank you. Happy New Year. And we'll talk again next week.
Hey, appreciate it. Also, love your shows with Hasselbeck. So I texted him, Matt, the other day, said, told him how much I enjoyed seeing him on here. So keep up the great work and Happy New Year.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. That is Mike Sando of The Athletic. And all class, as always. I am... not always class. I'm, you know, I try to be the majority of the time in that mode, but sometimes my lesser instincts take over. I appreciate all of you for hanging out and listening. I do want to kind of go over some of the storylines here. I'm going to go over like the injury report as well. We'll talk about that in a second. Before we do that, if you haven't already figured out how to go to this game and you're interested in going, it's not too late. And here's a decent way to get a deal. Take advantage. I certainly have, and a lot of great shows you can see, get games, and you want to do those all with SeatGeek. Also, simplyseattle.com. Promo code HawkBlogger15 still good for 15% off. Now is the time to get your Seahawks playoff gear. And I got some news that I won't be able to share till after the game, but there's some really good stuff available now. There will be more stuff available soon. So make sure you use code HawkBlogger15 at simplyseattle.com to get your best deal on Seahawks gear. And of course, download the Sleeper app. Great stuff. Catch up with all things. I know fantasy football is probably over for you, but you can check in on NBA, NHL, whatever it is that you love and follow. And for a limited time, you can also use promo code Hawks to get $100 match on your first deposit. Terms and conditions apply. See Sleeper's terms of use for details. Currently operational over 25 states. Check out Sleeper today. All right, we got a super chat here. Let me get this on stage. And it comes from It's Zeke YT. Go Hawks. Go Hawks. F. Lombardi, that guy's a snob, Brian. You have loyal followers, not washy bots. And if you haven't already, go watch Avatar 3 in IMAX 3D. I haven't actually. I got a little scared away because somebody was like, man, I felt trapped in the movie theater for over 3 hours. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do that, but I did like the last one. I was kind of surprised I liked the last one. So I'll take that under advisement. Appreciate it. And you know what? Like I've said this a million times and it's true. What we do here, I mean, this is what is this? I'm sitting in my office in my house. This is a YouTube channel and we have TikTok and Instagram. I'm like middle-aged. Like, I didn't play the sport at any meaningful level. And, you know, I just talk about a team that I love. This is not that serious. I don't feel special or unique or anything like that. So what I do feel is lucky, fortunate, grateful, and excited. I'm excited about this game. And, you know, I like a little sports hate. I like a little rivalry. I enjoyed that time with Jeffrey Dean Morgan yesterday. He's awesome. He and I are, I think, simpatico on what it's like to how we feel about sports and the team. And it is deep. It's a deep, like, it's a deep emotion. And, you know, if you, I've seen this not just with Mr. Lombardi, but, you know, with other folks that think that they're special because they're a reporter and that they have a huge, like, self-image, self-esteem built into that. And I'm like, okay. I mean, okay. I don't generally think reporting is as much of a feat and as much as something to feel like egotistical about as doing what these guys do, which is like a 0.001 percentile athletic feat every single time they step on the field. And the coaches and the hours that they put in and the details and all that stuff. Like that to me, part of the reason I do this is because I'm in awe of it. I respect it. I can't do it. And so I enjoy just covering it. But you know, some people want to make it about themselves. That is not going to be me, or at least I'm going to do my best to not make it about myself. So speaking of not making it about myself, let's talk more about this game. So injury report, if you did not hear it from yesterday, was released because it's a Saturday game. That was essentially, quote, the Friday practice report. So we got the final game designations. We did not get to talk to Mike McDonald, which is normally what happens. The report comes out, then we talk to him. Well, at pretty much the same time. Now we got the report and we talked to him today. So I'll be talking to Mike later today with the rest of the media. And here's the thing. Charles Cross out, not going to play. Josh Jones, questionable. And he was a limited participant in practice yesterday. We'll see how, like, I think they expect he's going to play. That's my guess. How he's going to hold up, that's another question. I would not assume that he's going to make it or that he's going to be at 100% or close to it. And so I think that's a question mark. I think we might see Amari Kite in this game. I don't think it's crazy to think that that could happen. So, you know, let's just watch and hope for the best in that regard. Rashid Shaheed cleared to play. Huge news. I think that is massive news. Why do I think that's massive news? One, I mean, the special team stuff is obvious. He's obviously made a huge difference in the return game. The 49ers coverage teams are pretty good. Definitely not as bad as the Rams or some of the others that they've faced. But still, it's great to have Rashid Shaheed back there as a threat. And then more importantly to me than the special teams impact is the 49ers, you know, there are question marks at cornerback there. And D'Amador Lenore is a good corner, although he has given up 5 touchdowns and against just 2 picks and over 104 passer rating on the year. I still think he's a good corner. And you're going to have a situation where I think Renardo Green's going to play for the first time. He's in the last few weeks, he's had a neck injury. Think he's going to play. And that's a big addition for them. Upton Stout, who's their nickelback, was in concussion protocol, still is, as far as we know, based on yesterday, but he was a full participant in practice. I think he is a day behind Rashid Shaheed. So my guess is that as long as he didn't have any like side effects or symptoms that reoccurred after practice, he's going to be cleared to play as well. So the 49ers will have their 3 top corners. And that doesn't mean they're great, but Upton Stout is, I think, a big addition, like a big get back for them, because I think there's a huge, huge drop off from him to Chase Lucas, who would have been the slot corner. And Stout's the kind of guy, he's like this little mini me guy out there, like short in stature, but kind of like Nate Robinson, like that kind of build. He's stocky, shorter, but he delivers a punch. I think he's brings a ton of energy to that defense. He's a bit of a playmaker. He also gives up a lot of plays. He gives up penalties. He gives up, you know, pass plays. Like, he's not perfect. He's still a rookie. I think he's going to be a good one, but I think he still can be targeted, but he's a big step up from Chase Lucas. And then Renardo Green, you know, Renardo Green is, I think, a solid cover corner. He's definitely a step up from Daryl Luter Jr., who's been playing for them. But Renardo Green's also the guy who JSN caught the 40-yarder on in the last drive against the 49ers the first time. And keep in mind, the Seahawks didn't really test the corners in that game. They just basically did a lot of short passing. So why this all comes back to Rashid Shaheed is, I think having him as a threat for that defense, not only does it challenge the coverage and challenge what they're going to have to do there, but it also helps the run game. Those guys are able to threaten deep, to affect where safeties are positioned, and are going to make it harder for the 49ers to bring an extra person down if the run game gets going. So Rashid Shaheed's critical. And I think it's really, really great news that he's going to play in this game. The other like injury news of note, I guess I would focus on what happened with the 49ers on that, in that regard. Keon White is a guy that I think has been a helpful addition for them, but he did not practice all week until he was a limited participant yesterday. He is listed as questionable. I don't think that's critical one way or another, but I think it's important for them. He's definitely one of their more athletic pass rushers. And then you've got Trent Williams, who's obviously the most focused, highlighted player on that list. He did not practice all week. He is questionable to play. And Kyle Shanahan said, look, if the doctors clear him and Trent says he can go, he's going to play. So even though he hasn't practiced, even though it's a short week, you know, Kyle Shanahan's leaving that door open. Ian Rappaport this morning reported that he thinks it's really unlikely that Trent Williams is going to play. If they have to go to their backup, he played well last week, but I'm telling you, there's a big difference when a team knows you and has film on you and knows how to like come up with a game plan that's, if Trent Williams is not there, this is how we're going to play. The Bears didn't have that. They also didn't have the people to exploit it. Although Austin Booker, I think, had a pretty decent game. So the Trent Williams thing, we'll see. George Kittle, also questionable. I think he'll play. Ricky Pearsall, questionable. I expect him to play. So that is where things are on the injury front. And these are significant. Like, they're significant. It's also just worth reminding folks that Derek Hall will be back. So they played last week without Derek Hall. He gave Trent Williams all he could handle in the first game of the season. Now, Derek's playing with a club wrap, you know, cast kind of thing on one of his hands. So I don't know how much that's affecting his ability to do his, you know, bull rush, power rush, things like that. But having him there is, I think, only a good thing for the Seahawks. So, I mean, let's talk a little bit just about the narratives in this game. Like, you can pick from all of these. There's ones about Sam Darnold, right? Can he play in the big game? I've talked to you before about how I think that's a really silly narrative because he played well in a lot of big games last year. And he's won some big games even this year, but it's still going to be a narrative. Is he going to play his best? Might be the better way to put it. Is he going to play his best in this situation? He hasn't done that yet. At least as far as the national narrative is. It is a like carbon copy in a lot of ways of where he was a year ago. 14 wins, a chance to get the number one seed, away game against a division opponent, and it didn't go well. And everyone's like, Sam didn't play well. Well, the fact that he had to throw the ball 40 times gives you a signal of how the run game was in that as well, how the pass protection was, how the game plan was. So, sure, Sam didn't have a great game, but neither did the Vikings, you know, offensive staff in general and offensive side. But it's a very similar setup to that game. There is the Mike McDonald, Kyle Shanahan narrative. Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, they're the big bad coaches in this division. They're the guys that everybody looks up to. Is this the time that Mike McDonald reasserts himself as one of those guys, or maybe a step above? I mean, you won't be able to do it in this game to say you're a step above, but it would be a big signal if Mike McDonald's able to have his team outduel Kyle Shanahan when they're coming in as hot as any offense in the league with a quarterback playing as well as Brock Purdy's playing. If the Seahawks are able to limit the 49ers, you know, below 25 points, that's a pretty big accomplishment. That's the defense winning. If they go over 30 points, then the defense, you know, has not had the game that the Seahawks wanted. 49ers won that tug of war a little bit. Does not mean that they're going to win the game. The Seahawks, you know, defense had some really bad moments against the Rams. They also stopped them at key moments to end up allowing the Seahawks to win. So there are ways that you can still have a winning performance, even if it's not necessarily meeting your standard, but you've got that conversation going on. You have got the Seattle versus San Francisco rivalry, right? Like, this goes back now for a while. And for a long time after, like, when the Seahawks, when Pete Carroll came in 2010, Jim Harbaugh and that 49ers team, they were the big bad team in the division. And they were the Justin Smith and Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman and, you know, Frank Gore and Colin Kaepernick. Like, they were just, they were a badass team. And they beat the Seahawks early on, including that game with Greg Roman making all the noise in the press box and being a jerk. But then the Seahawks beat them in 2012 on that Sunday night game, 42-13. And the Seahawks basically were their daddy for 8 years after that. Like, the 49ers could not beat the Seahawks for that period of time. Russ was their daddy, the whole thing. It was like Pete dominated Shanahan. Then, sorry, that was not all Shanahan, but Pete dominated the 49ers. Shanahan comes in 2017, 2018, still not good, still getting beat. And then 2019, and they come in here to Lumen Field in the last game of the season, in a game that the winner won the division, and in the 49ers' case would get the number one seed. They won it on a very close game, and the 49ers dominated this matchup after that point. Shanahan, Purdy, like, well, at that time it was Jimmy G, but eventually Purdy, they dominated the Seahawks for years. And it wasn't until Geno and Mike McDonald went down to the Bay last year and beat them. That was the first time they'd won in 6-7 games. So it's been back and forth. There's this kind of inflection point right now in this rivalry of who's the bigger, badder team. It feels like the 49ers generally are aging and some of their best players are not going to be on the team or playing football very much longer. Talking about Trent Williams, George Kittle, Kyle Juszczyk, like, there's some stuff there. Even Fred Warner, he's still young, but, you know, he's heading past his prime in the next few years. But Nick Bosa is kind of on that list as well. Seahawks feel like an ascending team, with the exception of one really critical position, the quarterback position. And this is a study in, would you rather have the better roster or the better quarterback? And I know that's a triggering question for Seahawks fans of like, hey, Sam might be the better quarterback. And if you feel that way, that's great. I'm not here to try to make you feel otherwise. But I think most objective analysis would have Purdy as the better quarterback in this game and over their careers. He's also playing at a higher level right now than Sam has been playing. And I am really curious to see whether or not this Seahawks defense is able to hold that offense down. I think they can. I think they will. But it's a storyline. Like, there's a lot of people NFL-wise, analyst-wise, that are just like, offense, you want to have a good offense, especially a good passing offense. It's more important than a good defense. Good defenses are too hard to build. They're too hard to maintain. They're too inconsistent. I still believe that an elite defense is a trump card in football. And it's a little bit like pitching in baseball, where, yes, you need to score runs to win. But if you have pitching that allows, like, the runs that you need to win to be 3-4 instead of 6-8, that's a big difference. It's a big, big difference. And I think that this Seahawks team has one of those defenses. And this is really, frankly, an opportunity for them to prove it. They did not prove it against the Rams last time. I think they've proved it the rest of this season. But this is a real chance. This is a real chance for them to do that. All right. We've got some super chats here. Brent Uendo says, no matter the seed we get, we'll likely face the Rams again. A bye gives us time to get defense communication and 12 noise more figured out. I imagine allowing historic yards has put Mike McDonald on a mission to do so. Yeah, I doubt that game sat well with Mike McDonald or the defense. Jay Walker says, looking forward to Brock in the rain. Yes. Well, it is looking increasingly like it may rain at some point during this game. I've been doing some research just to try to get separate fact from fiction on Brock Purdy in weather, and I've not finished with it yet. So, but based on what I've seen, generally, he has not been good in the rain, and it is something that 49ers fans do not like when it's coming to a Brock Purdy game. Seahawks 17 says the Seahawks could rush for 200 plus yards in this game. Everyone's forgetting about our running backs and great wide receiver blocking. I love it. And I certainly am not someone who's forgetting about that. I think when I look at this game, let's take it, you know, opponent unit versus yours. So like, if you could say offense versus defense and vice versa, and that's fine. But let's talk about like Seahawks rushing offense versus 49ers rushing defense. Seahawks have been a top 10 EPA per rush efficiency team since week 10. That's more than half a season. So at some point you got to acknowledge it. The 49ers are one of the worst run defenses in football. That's a pretty big advantage. The 49ers pass defense, one of the worst in football, does not give up a lot of explosives. They do not rush the passer well. They do not take the ball away well. This is the reality. The Seahawks offense, passing offense, has struggled to be efficient of late. They are probably around 20th in terms of overall efficiency over the last, since like week 12, probably. I don't know for sure, but around that. And what they are doing well is they're still scoring points. The Seahawks percentage of drives that result in points is 50% since week 12, which ranks fifth in the NFL. So even though the Seahawks offense is not as efficient or explosive as it was, they are scoring. And they're also getting help from other places. If you look at, I'll pull this up real quick. We've talked about it a million times, but the Seahawks offense, you know, scuffling a little bit since that Rams game. But how many points do you think they've averaged over that time? In six games since, they've averaged 29.3 points per game. Now, not all of that's offensive scoring. I get it. But the bulk of it is. So, I think the Seahawks passing game still has an advantage. I think it's less of an advantage than the run game has against the 49ers run defense. But look, I thought that the 49ers game plan was really good the first game. I thought Robert Saleh had a really good plan. I thought that their interior players, Khalil Davis, Jordan Elliott, played better than I expected them to. I think CJ West is a guy that's been making some noise lately and making some difference. Keon White can be a guy that is disruptive. I think Bryce Huff, as a pass rusher against either an injured Josh Jones or a rookie bright-eyed Amari Kite, is an advantage for the 49ers. So it's not like there's nothing going for the 49ers. And you don't have to be a great interception team if there's tipped balls. Like, that's not a skill. That's just, you know, if you're in the right place at the right time. And Sam's thrown a lot of tipped passes. So, I think that the Seahawks have clear advantages. I think there's reasons for the 49ers to feel hopeful on that side, but we'll see. On the other side, 49ers run offense is not very good. Now, it's been better lately, but it's not very good. And when they're facing the Seahawks, this is the best rush defense in the NFL, and it's got the largest gap between their quality of DVOA rush defense and the second place team since 1991. So it's a very different run defense in terms of quality than you're going to face the rest of the time. So the 49ers, they've rushed for over 135 yards in their past three games and four of their past five. So their run game is coming around. When they don't rush for 100 yards, it's rough for them. And Christian McCaffrey, they have to hope, even though he's going to play, they have to hope his back holds up for this whole game. It was starting to stiffen on him in the last game, and he's going to be treated like a workhorse in this one, like he was before. The 49ers passing offense against the Seahawks pass defense. This is the main event. This is the main event because, as we've said, there's no one hotter than Brock Purdy and the passing offense for the 49ers right now. It is fueling everything for them. Seahawks pass defense is the second best in the NFL by DVOA and number one in a lot of areas. And they did pretty damn well against the 49ers pass offense in week one. So if you just really look at it objectively, one of the biggest advantages in this game should be the Seahawks running offense against the 49ers rushing defense. Whether that will actually come to pass, we will see. Let me check Venmo super chats, venmo.com/Brian-Nemhauser. We got a couple here. Kirill Kotov says, "You have the best sports show in the world, man." Well, that's nice. Thanks, man. "Wondering how you all think this team compares to our other playoff squads in the past decades in terms of fan support. Go Hawks, beat the 49ers." I don't want to go long on this, but I'll just say, you know, there's a lot of passionate Seahawks fans out there across, not just in Seattle, not just in the Northwest, but across the planet, which is really cool. And I can see it all on who's listening and all that stuff is really cool. I still believe that the falling in love moment for this fan base with this team is in process. And I think a win against the 49ers would go a long way. I think, honestly, that would be it. But, you know, if it's Sam throwing three interceptions and the Seahawks still winning, I still think there's going to be people sitting on the sidelines, or at least a little bit cautious about putting their whole heart into it. And I understand it. There's honestly no judgment here. It's just, to me, the shame of it is, like, what's the downside of going all in? That you're going to be hurt more? Like, I get that, but it's already 16 games into a season where they're 13-3. They're playing for the number one seed. I'd risk my heart if I were you, but everyone's allowed to do what they want. Joey Hamilton says, "We haven't seen an opposing running back top 30 receiving yards since week two. Is that Eamon worry? If so, is Nick versus CMC the biggest matchup to watch?" Well, I didn't know that. I'm actually going to verify that, if you don't mind, not because I don't believe you, because I just haven't looked at that and I want to look at who's involved. So I'll pull that up while I'm talking here. But the thing that I would say, first of all, is it can't be Nick because Nick wasn't playing until like week four or five, something like that. It was a few games before he was back out there. So I'm going to go week two, but it is interesting. And the Seahawks have at times had trouble with running backs. Let's say over 30 receiving yards. They've had trouble with running backs out of the backfield, I thought. But they've been really, really good lately. Let's get opponent. Seahawks, and let's look for position. Let's make it running back clear. Let's get running backs. Okay. This will give us at least some clue. So I've got different results here. Jalen Warren. So you said since week two. Yeah, Jalen Warren had 86 yards receiving against the Seahawks. They had that crazy play. Amari DiMercato of the Cardinals had 40 yards receiving in week 10. Tyler Algier had 33 yards receiving in week 14. Amir Abdullah of the Colts had 32. And then Rashad White in week 5 also had 30 yards receiving. So there's been a few that have had some receiving yard days, but you're right. It's been a while. And Christian McCaffrey in the first game, that was a huge part of how he was very inefficient on the ground, but he killed the Seahawks as a receiver. And so I think that's a huge factor in this game. And, you know, we'll see. Hopefully Nick being out there helps. Hopefully Ernest and Drake Thomas, who wasn't there for the first game, all that helps. But we will find out. We will find out. Roland Luce says, let Sam cook. Yeah, I think we're all in the, like, let's let Sam be Sam and be aggressive. I think if you're hoping for Sam to pitch a perfect game with no turnovers, like, that's that might be hoping against hope. But we will see. I'm made aware that I think Mr. Lombardi has responded to my tweet. I'm going to go see what he said. I'll leave my responses offline, but appreciate all of you. If you haven't given the show a like and click subscribe, please do. Love your 5-star reviews over on Apple Podcasts. Makes my day. 5 stars really helps. We're up to 4.8. Would love to keep going up even higher. Folks, have a great rest of your Friday. I'll be heading down to the Bay Area later today. We'll do Seahawks Saturday tomorrow. It's going to be both Jeff Simmons and Evan Hill. They both wanted to be on, so we're going to do that tomorrow morning. Then, of course, we will have a post-game show after the game. Until then, have a great day. I'm Brian Emhauser. This has been another episode of Hawk Blogger Mornings.